It is fall 1972. In an office in Romania, a phone is ringing. It's an office that belongs to the agent of a tennis player named Elie Năstase. Nasty, for short. Starting in the 1960s, Nasty clawed his way to the top of pro tennis, beating out the likes of the American great Stan Smith, and doing it with his trademark arrogance. Nasty is cocky and crude, but despite all that, he's also one of the most popular athletes in the world. Like a lot of European players, Nasty used to wear apparel made by Adidas, the German-based sneaker giant. But more recently, he's taken to sporting a pair of shoes called Match Points, which are made by a young company out of Oregon in the USA. Which, as it turns out, is the purpose of this particular call. Hello? The caller, in his brisk American accent, identifies himself as a one-time runner named Phil Knight, founder of, along with his former track coach Bill Bowerman, a Portland company called Nike. Nike is only a few years old, but already, by focusing on technical improvements, Nike has made a big splash on the growing sneaker market, a market that includes, among others, New Balance, Diadora, Converse, Reebok, and what Knight likes to call the biggest monster out there. You know the one. Adidas has deep roots in Europe, and they've succeeded in signing dozens of the world's most popular athletes to endorsement deals. Deals that ensure Adidas remains in front of as many eyeballs as possible. Knight understands that if he's going to compete globally with Adidas, he's going to need at least a few high-profile athletes endorsing Nike. Even if they are, you might say, Nasty. And Nasty, the man, is a good bet since he already wears Nikes. Knight wants to seal this special relationship by paying him enough not to give so much as a thought to lacing up a pair of Adidas shoes. Over the phone, he suggests to Nasty's agent that he'd be willing to pay the tennis player $5,000 for his exclusive endorsement. He breaks into a cold sweat as he makes the offer. Truth be told, he doesn't exactly have $5,000 laying around. How about $15,000?
$10,000, it's absolutely as high as I can go.
Deal. A few days later, Knight flies to Omaha, where Nasty is competing in a tournament. Over dinner with Nasty and his wife, who's a model, Knight presents Nasty with the papers, and he signs them. One bottle of wine is consumed, and then another. That evening, Knight returns to his hotel room more than a little tipsy. He feels grand, wouldn't you? Kingmaker, a tycoon. Which brings to mind another feeling almost instantly. Thanks to Nasty and his agent, there's a feeling of lightness in his wallet. But as queasy as he might be in the wee small hours of inebriated reflection, Knight has no idea how much worse he could be feeling right now if only he knew what Adidas was up to right now. Well, as it happens, the German firm has been collecting hundreds of endorsements.
We get support from Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb is often one of my favorite parts of a trip, especially on business travel. Instead of slogging to another hotel and waiting in line after you've been driving or flying all day, there is nothing better than landing in a place that, well, really feels like a home away from home. Maybe you've stayed in an Airbnb before and thought to yourself, you know, this actually seems pretty doable. Maybe my place could be an Airbnb. Well, I'm here to tell you it could be. You could be sitting on an Airbnb and not even know it. It might be as simple as starting with your spare room, or maybe even your whole place when you're away. Say you and your family are headed away for a much-deserved spring break. Well, why not Airbnb your place and make some extra money towards the trip? Win-win. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. Today we're exploring the multi-million dollar rivalry between the two biggest sneaker manufacturers on earth, Nike and Adidas. This is Episode 3, Walking Billboards. In the last episode, we looked at the origins of these two corporations born on separate sides of the Atlantic in very different eras and run by very different kinds of executives. Today, we're going to fast forward a bit to the 1970s and the first real collision between the two, which took place, not coincidentally, at the dawn of the era of big-ticket endorsements by top athletes. Of course, as long as there have been professional sports, there have been professional athletes willing to accept money to wear certain clothes or attach their fame to other brand names. Consider the case of Honus Wagner, the early 20th century baseball player, who famously allowed his likeness to be affixed to cigars and razor blade advertisements. In 1905, Wagner was paid to endorse a certain bat company you may have heard of, Louisville Slugger. But the deal Wagner and Louisville struck was a little more than nominal compared to the endorsement machinery that comes online starting in the 1960s. Across the globe, television networks are signing syndication deals with various sports leagues. In Europe, it's rugby and soccer. In the U.S., it's Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and the National Hockey League. In January of 1968, a now-defunct syndication network called TBS broadcast the first nationally viewed college basketball game. It's an exhilarating match between the UCLA Bruins and the Houston Cougars that goes down in history as the game of the century.
The official paid attendance tonight, 52,693, the largest paid audience to ever see basketball anywhere at any level. 3 seconds.
The game is so dramatic that it is broadcast daily around the country for the next week, and the number of fans explodes. So do the number of broadcasts of college games. It's a revelation for the entertainment industry and for Americans who can watch their favorite athletes compete, too, in real time, almost any day of the week. Now fans can just flick on the television set to watch their favorite teams, tracking players on basketball courts, football fields, and baseball diamonds. Of course, athletic companies see something else here. The world's largest billboards, not just on the walls of the stands, but running, passing, dribbling, batting, kicking, three-dimensional ambassadors of all things in athletic wear. A marketing revolution is about to take hold. And it's the Dassler family that first leverages these developments on a mass scale. When we last checked in with the Dasslers, Rudy and Adi had parted ways, with Rudy starting Puma and Adi founding Adidas. By the 1960s, Adi is still an active presence at Adidas headquarters in Germany. But born at the turn of the century, well, he's getting on in years. He's taking more of a back seat at his own company, leaving most of the day-to-day decisions to his 30-something son, Horst. In temperament, Horst is less like his father than his estranged uncle, Rudy. He's happier cutting deals than he is at the drafting table. His motto, business is about relationships. Decades on, Horst remains famous for his business acumen. He understands that it's all fine and good to make a nice shoe. But in the television age, with millions of people around the world having color TVs parked in their living rooms, well, if your shoe isn't on that box, you might as well not bother making it at all. He goes hard after contracts with top athletes, often competing directly with Puma, which is now controlled by Rudy Dassler's son and Horst's cousin, Armin. And Horst is not above playing rough either. 1968, the Mexico City Summer Olympics soon will be underway, and Horst and Armin have been doling out cash to athletes in various disciplines. They don't ask much in exchange, only that the athletes wear the right shoes when they compete. In advance of the games, Horst travels to the Olympic trials near Lake Tahoe in California. There he happens to note that a top U.S. runner, Lee Evans, is wearing Puma sneakers, known as brush shoes, which have dozens of tiny pins on the soles to improve traction. When Evans completes a record-setting 400-meter dash, Horst starts muttering aloud to everyone within earshot, "Those pins,
They're not that different from spikes, are they? And don't Olympic track regulations forbid athletes from competing with more than 6 spikes on each sole? Well, that can't be fair. Horse sits back and waits for what he knows will happen. A game of telephone ensues, and soon, Horst's objections have reached the ears of Olympic officials, who decide that Evans's record is null and void. Not exactly a good look for one of Puma's most visible celebrity endorsers. Puma is left flat-footed. Still, it presses forward. By the late 1960s, it has become apparent to executives at both Puma and Adidas that if the companies are to continue to grow, they will need to expand further into the United States, and particularly into the fastest-growing sports, professional basketball and football. Fresh off the Olympic trials embarrassment, Puma strikes first, paying a young quarterback named Joe Namath $25,000 to wear its sneakers on the gridiron.
NBC Sports presents the third AFL-NFL World Championship game, the Super Bowl.
When Namath's New York Jets beat out the Baltimore Colts to win the 1969 Super Bowl, the man who'd be celebrated as Broadway Joe is sporting those Puma shoes.
Namath to Snell. Snell barrels Bobby Boyd over and then is dropped at the 14.
The payoff is immediate and big. 400,000 pairs of Namath-branded Pumas are sold that year. Instead of attempting to follow Puma into the football arena, Adidas fires back with the release of a basketball sneaker called the Superstar. Before the Superstar, the vast majority of professional basketball players wore Chuck Taylor All-Stars. You know, floppy canvas shoes made by a Massachusetts company called Converse. But Horst and his designers determine that the All-Stars leave the ankles too prone to twists and strains. They also figure that players would be better served by stronger toe protection. Working out of a lab in France where Adidas had recently expanded, the company devises the first run of Superstars with their iconic shell-toe, triple-stripe design and thick cuff that encircles the ankle. And soon, most of the members of the Boston Celtics, winners of the 1969 basketball championships, are wearing those Superstars. By the early 1970s, approximately 85% of pro basketball players hit the courts in Adidas shoes. Some are being paid a lot of money to do it. Example A, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, a 7'2" Los Angeles Lakers star who is signed to a deal rumored at $25,000 per year. Kareem is the face of a new generation of basketball talent, and he becomes the first NBA player to get his own custom sneaker. It's dubbed the Adidas Jabbar. When Kareem tears up the court in front of millions of viewers, it's the three stripes the fans are seeing. Still, no company can hang on to market control forever. And soon, a new challenger is rising out of the West Coast. And unlike Adidas, a big European corporation with only a small permanent footprint in the U.S., this newcomer is American to the core.
Let's face it, after a night with drinks, it can be hard to bounce back the next morning. But let me tell you, if there's a surefire way to wake up feeling fresh after a night of drinking, it's with ZBiotics. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for that rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. Drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. I have a friend who had to go to a major conference the night before. Well, you know how these pre-conference cocktail sessions can go. But he cracked open a bottle of ZBiotics before that first drink. The next day, he got up feeling ready to give that presentation his 100%. Head on over to ZBiotics.com/BW to get 15% off your first order when you use BW at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/BW and make sure to use the code BW at checkout for 15% off. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
Hayward Field, home of the University of Oregon's track squad. A lean and angular runner races around the track, his legs gobbling up the meters. His name is Steve Prefontaine, Pre for short, and he's destined to become one of the most famous runners in history. Nearby stands his coach, Bill Bowerman. Bauer sees something very special in Pre. He always wanted to race out front from the start, like he was trying to get away from something. Just where and when this compulsion came from, no one can say for sure. Pre and Bowerman grow closer, and when Bowerman joins Phil Knight to start Blue Ribbon, which would later become Nike, he asks Pre to wear his shoes. Pre agrees. I mean, why not? These shoes are good. In the summer of 1972, Pre sets the American record in the 5,000 meters at an Olympic qualifying event, but in the actual Olympic race, he narrowly misses the podium altogether, not even a bronze. He's furious at himself. Phil Knight tries to lift his spirits.
Hey, the city officials in Eugene, did you know they're naming a street after you?
Great, what are they going to call it, 4th Street?
But soon, with Knight and Bowerman's encouragement, Pre is back on the track, setting records again. There's a problem, though. The runner's broke.
You can't go around with a begging bowl. We'll get you a job.
Where?
Let's not worry about that part right now.
Soon, Pre is working, between races and training, out of a Nike storefront in Oregon. His annual salary is $5,000 a year. He gets a business card that reads, National Director of Public Affairs. The reasons why some brands fail and others soar are many, of course. Sometimes it's the result of determination. And sometimes it's the result of something close to luck. You know, being in the right place at the right time. Or finding the right person at the right time. For Nike, which has a fraction of the market clout of Adidas in the early 1970s, Steve Prefontaine is that person. Not just an athlete, but charismatic, handsome, outgoing. Remembering those years, Phil Knight once said that Pre preached Nike as a gospel and brought thousands of new people into our revival tent. He is a symbol of rebellion and iconoclasm. Every new race he goes to, every athlete he meets, Pre makes sure to highlight the benefits of those new sneakers by that small company back in Oregon. Brand recognition grows, of course, and so do sales. Thousands of pairs of Waffle Racers disappear from shelves. But now Knight has a dilemma. A choice, you might say. He can position Nike as a running shoe company, or he can go big time, expand into other sports, and try to go head-to-head with Adidas and Puma and Converse on their own turf. Knight decides to play long ball and take on the competition. In September of 1971, Knight flies back to Japan, the country where Nike's precursor, Blue Ribbon Sports, had been born. There, he places orders with a manufacturer called Nisho for several new styles of sneakers. The sample versions of the shoes are finished a few days later on a Sunday. There's no one in the Nisho offices, but it doesn't matter. Knight has a key, so he heads out to the company's headquarters on his own and lets himself into the lobby. For hours, he stares at the shoes that will make Nike or break it. Some of these sneakers, like the Cortez Racer, already have names, but others don't. And over the course of the day, shuttered away in the empty office, Knight embarks on a naming spree, removing each pair from its box and holding it up to the light. He names one pair of white leather tennis sneakers the Wimbledon, and another the Forest Hills, after the location of the first U.S. Open. He names one of the running shoes the Marathon. And for his biggest gamble, a mid-top basketball shoe that will compete directly against the Adidas Superstar, he goes with Blazer, a nod to his hometown NBA team, the Portland Trail Blazers. After sunset and exhausted, Knight ducks back outside. In the neon darkness, Tokyo's streets are buzzing with activity, and Phil Knight's head is buzzing too. It's a transformative moment, and he knows it. He feels spent, but he feels proud. I felt everything I ever hoped to feel after a day's work. I felt like an artist, a creator. I looked back over my shoulder, took one last look at the Nisho offices. Under his breath, Knight mutters, "We made this." It takes some time for Adidas to feel the heat from its newest competitor, but when it does, it acts quickly. In the run-up to the 20th Olympiad in Munich, just a few months before Phil Knight makes his pitch to a tennis player named Nasty, Horst dumps thousands of dollars into paying and outfitting an estimated 80% of the athletes at the Games in Adidas apparel, from shoes to tracksuits. And then, the masterstroke. Do you remember Mark Spitz? He was kind of like the Michael Phelps of the 1970s. Handsome American swimmer, dazzling smile, a disco mustache, his chest covered in gold medals. He was an athlete at the absolute pinnacle of his sport. Well, after Spitz nets his first gold in the 1972 Games, Horst makes him a proposal. "Look, we'd really like you to wear our shoes when you climb up there on the podium. It's a great opportunity." "That's not going to work. You know those warm-up pants we wear when we get out of the pool? No one's going to be able to see our shoes." "Okay, I've got an idea."
Spitz turns for home. Mathis is to his left. Heidenreich is to his right.
The next time Spitz gets up on a podium, he's carrying a pair of Adidas Gazelle sneakers in his hands. And when he leaves the pool area, he's carrying those shoes with him too, making sure the cameras catch every stitch. The Olympic Committee is furious. How could Spitz and Dassler turn a hallowed sporting ground into a fashion runway? But Dassler is unapologetic. He's a businessman, and he's made a smart business move. By the mid-1970s, Adidas is selling more than 150 kinds of shoes and has expanded heavily into the larger world of sports apparel. At this point, Adidas is raking in an incredible $500 million in revenue a year. But as in the world of sports, no company is dominant forever. Phil Knight and Nike are about to take flight.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
In our next episode of Nike versus Adidas, Phil Knight makes his move, and a young player named Michael Jordan gives the Americans a very big boost. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Matthew Scher wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound design by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producers are Marshall Louis and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
When you're committed to raising the standard, you're bound to ruffle some feathers. At Happy Egg, we like to say we farm differently. But in reality, we produce eggs the way people used to, by partnering with local small family farmers who raise our happy hens on 8 or more acres. Because in our opinion, farming shouldn't be complicated. It should be happy. Choose happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.